next speaker, Dr. Scott Awol, and he will be looking at piracy and Pahang in the 19th century.
Thank you all for coming. I really appreciate you being here and inviting me. I recognize that this might be a little touchy subject, but I'll try to do it. All right, so when we're looking at piracy, we also kind of have to note that there is a blurred line a lot of times between the merchant mariner, the pirate hunter, and it's at times difficult to distinguish between these actors. But we also have to recognize that wealth seized through these actions played an important part in redistribution of wealth in Malay states through cruising. I generally use the word cruising if I want to be like non-judgmental about it or non-legalistic in my view. Particularly in the early part of the 19th century, slavery played an important role in piracy as captive slaves bolstered political support for elites. So the more people you had supporting you, the greater your power and prestige was. So there also is a sort of another issue with this, is that while pirates are acting on behalf of the regional states, contrary to oftentimes the interests of people living within those countries, this sort of system that existed at this time oftentimes is at odds with a lot of post-World War II national identity and the way that people wanted to view or write about history. And I'm going to discuss a potential reason why that might be, and also keep it in the framework of why other reasons why scholars might be hesitant to talk about the subject or talking about it in a manner that is different from what I'm doing. All right, next slide, please. So this is usually something that pops up whenever I talk about the subject. I personally use this word, piracy or pirate, oftentimes it is a reflection of the sources employed, especially by the victims of it. I think it's the least we can do for the people who lost everything and were brave enough to actually have their words recorded. Admittedly, a lot of the testimony is through the transcriptions and translations of the colonial system, whether it be police stations, Royal Navy officers, or others. And I feel this also compounds the need to use piracy or the acceptability to use this as a word, because you're also suggesting in that context, if you're going to the police station, that implies that some sort of crime has happened or something that you feel is illicit. Another reason is that at this time, there were treaties between Malay states and European powers, particularly the Netherlands and the East India Company or Great Britain. And these treaties pretty clearly specify that piracy is going to be prohibited, although the treaties evolve on how that is enforced. And the third, in my research, I've seen at least a couple instances, while this is fairly rare, that even if you were of the elite class, if you were captured, you could be held ransom if you were engaging in these activities. And one of the most famous cases in 1874 in the Civil War resulted in execution. So, but I do want to keep in mind that being called a pirate at this stage was a pretty serious insult and was not something that you would do lightly. One source that I found suggests that Sultan Hussein Shah of Johor was himself one of the people captured during these sort of activities. So one on the right is from the National Library of, sorry, the National Museum of Malaysia. That is, the one on the right is a figurehead. If you notice on the one on the left, the picture of this tambil, you can see in the toward the bow of the section over here, you can see the guns. These are called, at least in English, bow chasers. And they usually are behind aquilons or bulwarks to protect the crew. As you can see, you know, there's a pretty well-decorated vessel, as Perahu and other vessels, my favorites are Pemajaja, were symbols of the state or symbols of prestige and power, and would play a defensive role, potentially as well, in keeping it close, safe from attack. So I know this is usually the boring part where we're talking about historiography, but I do think I can at least make it somewhat interesting. One of the things that I kind of noticed is that mid-19th century liberal narratives, they're kind of similar to a lot of the post-war narratives. And a lot of these materials you can find online for free if you'd like. Sherwood Osborne, he was a Royal Navy officer. He blames European powers, particularly the Dutch, for the oppression of Malays as being the cause of disruption and chaos. Samuel Congleton, through Reverend Wallace, he blames the head of money system for increasing piracy. This is actually Maxwell Benson, not the other Maxwell, and he was critical of the expansionist policies predicated on piracy. So these actors, they tended to try to persuade Europeans and others to treat Asians with greater compassion and try to engender a sense of restraint. Fast forward a few decades, I'd say the two at least most famous English language writers on this subject are Tarling and Trockey. Tarling argues that British forces are using piracy for justification for expansion, and Trockey is arguing that counter-piracy operations effectively destroy the Malay shipping industry. The first one, for Tarling, there is some element of truth to that, but my own research does not suggest that that is at the core of the issue, and I have not seen any significant evidence to support Trockey's assertion. And I don't necessarily want to get too speculative on these individual motivations, but I do want to talk about the overall general context in which this is operating. So, why is there this sort of similarity between the two? Well, some of the research that I have done suggests that, particularly during World War II, there was the spread of a particularly aggressive form of nationalism. I picked these two figures as being important. There are many others, but I felt that these were the two most compelling cases. The man to the left is Shumai Okawa. He is an important Japanese intellectual and Pan-Asianist. He was also a propagandist during the war and tried to promote Japanese aggression and Asian unity. He portrayed Japan's imperial mission during this time as a divine mission to unify Asia and also destroy both the United States and Great Britain. He sought to mobilize Asians for the struggle, and the individual on the right, Indonesians will know, is Bung Tuma. He was also a Japanese propagandist before the war ended, and I feel that plays an important role in this sort of historiographical trend shifting his charisma and his historiographical narrative to try to promote mass mobilization, particularly against British Indian forces during the temporary British occupation in 1940. atrocities committed by Western powers against Asians. Bong Joon-ho, I think what his main difference is he starts to elevate this character of the anti-colonial hero. His favorite seems to have been Dipo Nagoro, who was famous for fighting the Java War in 1825 to, I believe, 1830. So I couldn't resist. I had to put what happened to these individuals. Mr. Okawa, he had a nasty case of syphilis, which caused his brain to go insane. So this is him during his war crime, tribunal, and I don't know if you can recognize the man on the bottom right, but that is the former Prime Minister Hideki Tojo. And if you notice, he is slapping Hideki Tojo on the back of his head during his war crime tribunal. And you can see the American soldier trying to restrain him somewhat futilely. Tsutomu, he, after the war, he kind of avoids politics as best I can tell, but during the Suharto regime, he protested against the corruption of that regime, which ended him in prison, as you can say. So I'm kind of wanting to shift away from these particular narratives and focus more on an autonomous history method. And just be a matter a bit more critical of those who professionally deprived others of their freedom, livelihood, and lives. So we're going to switch over to the next slide, please. So switch over to the 19th century again. And there was a British policy to suppress piracy and slave trade. However, in my experience, they tended to be a bit more cautious in how they went about this. This is a lithograph of HMS Wolfe and the East India Company vessel Zephyr, and their boats and gunboats engaging a fleet, Malay Parahu, off of Romania. So that's, for those who don't know, that is east of Singapore, but still part of Johor. I believe the original currently is at the NLB in Singapore. But they did try to coerce using blockades, sanctions, over a foreign invasion itself, as that would be costly and kind of go against their overall policy in the region. However, by the year 1836, the situation in the region becomes fairly untenable, and there are too few East India Company warships in the region to actually do much about it. Malay cruising offered opportunities for people to seize loot, which in turn was redistributed, particularly to patrons and the sovereigns, and granted combat experience to those naval forces. So it could be a sort of training session, if you will, for those willing to engage in this activity. All right, so the man on the left is Henry Ducie Chads. He is the commander or captain of HMS Andromache, which if you look at the bottom is one of those two European ships in the middle. And on the right, top right, is a sister ship of HMS Raleigh, it's a brig sloop, so similar to the one that was dispatched and the operation that I'm talking about. So the Governor General of Bengal or India wanted to institute a pass system. So this system where you essentially carry a pass saying how many weapons you had, your cargo, and various details. And this system would help keep track of legitimate traders and make sure that they were obeying the rules. So the Dutch had already sort of started to implement a similar system, although it doesn't look like there was much details or as many details. And this particular operation where both these vessels had gone to Bahang, they were seeking the freedom of slaves or captives who were placed there. Oftentimes when boats would sail into the region crewed by the Royal Navy, you would have captives try to jump into the boats, swim to the boats, to try to attain their slavery. Many of the prisoners were actually from what's today Southern Vietnam. So, looking at Pahang at this time, it was ruled by Bendahara Tun Ali, and he's mainly using ministers of Arab descent to run his government. At this time, it seems that Pahang's overlord is actually the Sultan of the Kingdom of Rialinga. Sultan Hussein Shah had already passed away in 1835, and it seems like his son lacked sufficient legitimacy to rule over all that much territory. Also, east coast of Malaya had more trade at this point than the west coast, so for the records that I have seen, there's a lot more commerce going on over here. It seems that pirates' favorite targets was the commerce headed between Singapore and Cochin China, and they would sell the crews in slavery, often at very low prices. The Chinese and others who were there might purchase them. They would justify this as, you know, an act of mercy, and they would act more as indentured servants, where if they had not done so, they would be executed. So, if we could just take a look at these. The one in the top right corner is from the World Museum of Leiden. The others are actually from the Smithsonian Museum. The top left one is, I believe, a royal vessel. And as you can see, a lot of them are armed. Some of the, at least at the Smithsonian, for whatever reason, the cannons seem to be either missing or lost or disintegrated. I'm not entirely sure. But I felt like these models were good representations of the vessels that were operating and conducting these sorts of activities during this time. So I put together these stats. The top one was compiled by customs officials in Singapore. The bottom one I compiled, so it's still a work in progress. As you can see, around 1836-35 is when you see a large increase in pirate attacks. These are not necessarily successful attacks, because if we're successful, then, well, nobody's really reporting it. So there may be some statistical issues because there was increased reporting, at least on the export side, because of the implementation of the pass system, but regardless of this, you can still see an increase of trade after this operation. So in conclusion, I argue that cruising played a critical role supporting Malay states such as Pahang by providing the state with plunder, naval experience, and slaves necessary to function. I'm still open to suggestions, comments, and eventually hope to write a monograph that's focusing more on the states rather than, as Charlie had done, by ethnicity. And I frankly did that with my dissertation. So thank you. I really appreciate your patience and your time.
Thank you very much, Dr. Abel. I think, again, a fascinating story of piracy and counter-piracy. Well done.